What's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
When someone you love is facing cancer, you want to do more than send a card or flowers that will wilt in a week. You want to actually help. That's where the BalmBox comes in. Our care packages are built from research with over 500 cancer patients and caregivers, packed with items people actually use during treatment. Think soothing, practical, thank goodness I have this kind of relief. For you, it's not just a gift. It's a way to show up in a moment where words fall short. For them, it's comfort, calm, and a reminder they're not alone. From chemo-friendly boxes to mastectomy recovery kits, even options for men, we've made it simple to give something that's elegant, premium, and genuinely useful. And yes, domestic shipping's always free on orders over $50, because making someone feel cared for shouldn't be complicated. So skip the empty get well soon. Send real help, real comfort, and maybe even a laugh. Visit thebalmbox.com. That's THEBALMBOX.com. Balm, like healing and care. The Balm Box. Because cancer patients don't need bouquets and brownies. They need Balm.
Hey there, ACRackers. I want to tell you about a CME conference that I will be speaking at in the new year from February 28th to March 7th, 2026. It is an amazing conference. It is the Holiday Seminars Conference in Maui at the Hyatt Regency Maui Resort and Spa. I have been there before. I've spoken at this before, and it is incredible. The family, the Smith family that puts this on, they really do an incredible job. It's going to be some amazing speakers. It's a beautiful hotel and an opportunity to really enjoy Hawaii and Maui, and especially at a time when Maui is trying to recover from the wildfires. They're really going all out to try to make the tourist experience an amazing one. So I think this is a great year to come, and the conference is going to be incredible. You're going to hear from amazing speakers who are going to go over really, really high-yield topics. I highly, highly recommend signing up for this. You can go to holidayseminars.com and click on the Maui link, and you can register there. You can use CME money. It is going to be amazing. So I hope I will get a chance to see you there. It'll be a ton of fun. Hello, and welcome back to ACRack. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and we've got a fabulous show for you today, one that I think is just crucially important and will make a big difference for a lot of people. I have with me Dr. Sam DeMaria. He's a professor and vice chair for research in the Department of Anesthesiology at the Mount Sinai Health System, and he recently published a book, and it is fabulous. I read it and just was totally into it, called The Invisible Cut, Incivility's Silent Toll on Healthcare. And in the book, he challenges the ingrained belief that incivility in medicine is simply an inconvenient part of the healthcare culture that we all experience. He argues that even seemingly minor acts of disrespect are not just morale killers, but direct threats to patient safety. The book is a comprehensive guide to understanding the root causes of incivility and implementing tangible solutions. He does a great job in the book of giving a lot of examples of solutions and things you can do, so I highly recommend you read it. But we get to talk to him today, and I'm very excited to do that. So, Sam, welcome to the show.
Jed, thanks for having me here.
So, fabulous job with the book. Tell me a little bit about how you got to the point of writing this book. How'd you get interested in this topic, and what pushed you to actually write a book on it?
Sure. I think, you know, the short story is that I've been lecturing on this topic for the past 5-6 years or so, coming off the heels of a study that I published with some colleagues about the effect of incivility on performance of anesthesia residents. But really, I think my experience with incivility in healthcare starts probably where it starts for most people in medicine, which was as a medical student. I opened the book with this because I think this was sort of illustrative of just the way most of us are introduced to the culture that still really exists in healthcare. You know, I was a third-year medical student, just really eager to get out in the clinical environment, very excited to do so. I was on my surgery rotation, And I should say, as a background, I'm a pretty blue collar kid growing up. I was used to sort of working on construction sites. That's what my dad's business was. So I wasn't sort of kind of like coming from a very gentle upbringing. It wasn't something that was sort of a problem to me to work with, like, you know, tough people rough around the edges. But, you know, here I am in the morning, 7:30. I'm scrubbing at the sink. It's my first big case, really, on the vascular surgery rotation. It's going to be an open AAA. And this little, you know, 5 foot tall, 75-year-old surgeon kind of comes through and literally hip checks me out of the way and says, "You're at my scrub sink," you know, and kind of just gives it to me and says, "They didn't tell you, or you're just too stupid to remember that you don't scrub here." And I just remember thinking, like, whoa, if this happened in, you know, the grocery store, this would be a big problem. But this guy just sort of physically accosted me. And the rest of that 2 week rotation on vascular was more of the same. You know, this is at the time when we finally got 80-hour work weeks for the residents. And I remember my vascular fellow who was supervising me saying, "Well, those don't apply to you guys as the med students. So we're going to work you to death." And they did. We were, you know, rounding at 4 a.m, changing the bandages, and then they would come in and tell us how badly we did and change them again. And I just remember thinking, you know, I know where I am on the totem pole. I don't need to be reminded physically and verbally every day. And it got me really curious, like, why do we work like this? Why do we treat each other this way? I mean, this isn't really going to get the best performance out of me. So, you know, I did, I think, what most people did. I sucked it up. I grinned and I bared it, and I made it through. And so, you know, this kind of really sparked in me, I think, an interest in just how we work, just generally thinking. And, you know, when I ended up as an anesthesia resident, I was very involved in our research program, and simulation was a big part of the kind of research I was interested in. It was a great lab, essentially, for studying how people performed, how they learned. And over time, when we did more and more performance-based sort of studies on anesthesia residents, anesthesia attendings, I thought this is a great place to really maybe quantify just how this kind of behavior affects the way we're performing. Because as a resident, I remember being in the operating room with a surgeon throwing things or screaming and just kind of afraid to speak up, afraid to look over the drape and say, "Hey, did you want this antibiotic instead of this antibiotic?" And I knew that just couldn't be good for us. And so that kind of led to me sort of more formally, academically being interested in the topic. And like I said, lecturing about this for the last 5 or 6 years really finally prompted me to put all my thoughts in one place, more or less, and put the book out.
Well, I'm so glad you did. I think it's such an important topic. I love the example you just gave of being in the grocery store. I mean, imagine you're at the cereal aisle, you're looking for your Cheerios that you want or whatever, and someone just comes and literally, you know, pushes you out of the way and says, you know, "How dare you? That's my spot," or something. I mean, it's just inconceivable. And yet, you know, It is, at least at that time, and you'll tell me if you think it's changed or not since then, but certainly that kind of thing was not uncommon back when it happened to you. But I guess let me ask you that. I mean, do you think that that level of, I mean, there's certainly incivility. I mean, we actually have had some experiences with folks doing their preoperative interview with a patient, and having the attending surgeon walk up and just interrupt mid-sentence and start talking as if no one else was there. It's not common in my experience, but it has happened. And, you know, so that's not physical, but it's still very rude verbally. So, but do you think the physical stuff is still happening? Like, where are we compared to when that happened to you?
Sure. I mean, I think overall we've got a better sense of culture in healthcare moving in a more civil direction. I think, at least physically, you don't really, the days of surgeons throwing their instruments, are probably long behind us outside of a handful of small pockets. And certainly, you know, there's never a place, for what amounts to workplace violence if it's a physical act. But more common, now is sort of the verbal abuse. And I'm not sure that we've got a good handle on that. In fact, there have been recent studies, largely out of the nursing literature, showing that especially since the pandemic, the incidence of verbal abuse has actually gone up. Because we're seeing a very stressed healthcare workforce, you know, these are very burnt out people. And again, not making an excuse for it, but you know, not everybody is self-actualized and is realizing what they're doing. So I think a lot of times people are lashing out. And you know, this was always a big message of mine when talking about this, is we're all guilty of incivility at some point, delivering incivility. And we're all vulnerable to it when it happens to us. And because of that, it's just a shared experience that we can all work on together and try to fix. But I don't think that it's going away anytime soon. I think that, you know, if anything, healthcare is getting more and more stressful. And so we're not necessarily coaching people to sort of work on this. We might even be rewarding many people in the workforce.
Yeah. So let's talk about why this is so pervasive. I mean, do you have a feel for that? Why is it so pervasive and underestimated? What's going on in our world of medicine?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the corporate literature on this, and Christine Porath is a real expert in this, has written really extensively in the literature about it, but it's all corporate workplace, legal workplace. There are two real reasons why people, just very broadly speaking, will commit acts of harassment, incivility, disrespect in the workplace. One is literally just fear. Many times people are fearful of things that aren't bubbling on the surface. The example I always give about our surgical colleagues is the reason that they're at the front desk stomping their feet and asking why their room is delayed is because they feel that if they don't do that, that they will sort of lose something, that they're worried that you're going to sort of take advantage of them if they don't kind of make it known that this is not the kind of thing that they're going to tolerate. So fear is a big part. And then stress and burnout are usually the second part of that. And as I already alluded to, and as I think everyone listening to this podcast knows, burnout in healthcare is not something that is alien to anybody. It's probably not something we've got a great handle on fixing. A lot of times we talk about resilience as a way of sort of almost passing the buck on our colleagues. We bring them granola bars and bring a dog to the office space and say, look, we're helping your wellness, but wellness and burnout is a little deeper issue of just sort of a handful of creature comforts at work. And so now you take the two of these things and you put them together and you take a very stressed workforce and you take a very fearful workforce and you get a lot of sort of lashing out. And that's usually the source of a lot of this. Now in healthcare in particular, there's an added layer that's been shown, and this is true elsewhere, but very, very true in healthcare. We've got this sort of brilliant jerk phenomenon where we've got people who are highly skilled and who have sort of habituated to abusing others around them to get their way. And because they are these brilliant jerks, people say, well, so-and-so can say whatever they want because they're the, you know, you name it, chair of the department, best anesthesiologist in the world, best surgeon in the world, and they kind of get a pass. And that's really a habit building positive reinforcement loop that allows them to think that this behavior is actually helping them.
Yeah. It's really multifactorial, and all the things you went over just resonate. Absolutely. I think, you know, you've got people, let's just look at surgeons for a minute, right? You've got surgeons who are going through a very grueling, challenging training where they are often getting treated badly and burned out. And then they become attendings and they are in a situation where it is seemingly permitted to lash out. Plus they're being put in a stressful environment in the OR. So they're now stressed out. And then there are stereotypes, right? So you've got, for just when I'm thinking about the surgeon anesthesiologist relationship, you've got the stereotype of the anesthesiologist who doesn't really care. They're just doing their Sudoku over there. And so it's an easy target to lash out at. I mean, there's so many things that lead into this, which of course makes it all the harder to address. But let's back up a second and let me ask you why. I mean, this is obviously, I don't believe that it's unimportant, but let's just ask the question, why do we care? So, you know, give us the reason why this is bad, because it sounds bad, but you know, what if being, people being jerks, didn't actually have any effect on anything, then we wouldn't maybe care, or maybe we'd say it's not that big of a deal, but we do. So why is this a big deal?
Sure. Yeah, I think this is a great place to start, because I think it's a nice thought experiment to say, let's say we're being just overly sensitive, for lack of a better, more accurate term. Does this reach the patient is really the question I think we want to ask ourselves, because we know that if you work in a hostile environment, you're going to quit. You're going to go somewhere else. But I was more concerned with the patient. Does the patient really experience this? So there's a lot of data that's very tangential. Certainly Cooper at Vanderbilt's published quite a bit of this, looking at, and again, I'm not picking on the surgeons here. I have a lot of great friends who are surgeons, but you know, we're anesthesiologists. So like, that's sort of our main counterpart. This is true and pervasive across disciplines. But if you look at surgeons who have a higher level of professional complaints, those surgeons have patients who have tend to have more morbid and outcomes following surgery. That's sort of strange if you think about it, right? Because many times it's hard to connect one to the other. Now, we've got lots of data like that that's very, very sort of glancing at the problem that shows that in surgery and medicine and critical care and lots of other settings, certainly in the emergency department, we see this as well in the data, that when you have the professionals who have a lot of professional misconduct, their patients just have worse outcome. Now, on the sort of big paper on this by Cooper and JAMA, they sort of, I think, overinterpreted their results, but I like their interpretation because it works to my benefit for when I give the talk. And they said that it's likely that these individuals create a culture that makes it very hard to care for their patients. So let's say they're a masterful surgeon at what they do, but maybe postoperatively, something happens on the floor and the nursing team is afraid to call the service and say, this is happening, that's happening. Might delay care, might make poor outcomes. So again, we've got some real world data. It's not really possible to, or ethical even, to study this in a way that connects the dots. Then there was a paper in the pediatric ICU literature that showed that if you have some code teams, you know, dealing with a simulated crisis, and you introduce a person who is very distracting in sort of a rude and dismissive way, someone who's just suggesting things in a way that's very aggressive or really just sort of like full of sort of disdain for the group there, the groups perform worse. And so sort of the amalgamation of this for my group is like, why don't we do a study where we kind of do the same thing with our anesthesia residents, because as you point out, they're the one in the operating room a lot of times. And while we're running around as attendings doing other things, so they have a lot more anesthesia hours in a way than your average academic attending does. And so we took them in, we used the validated scenario that we have, which is sort of an occult hemorrhage on an otherwise totally healthy person that's just refractory to every kind of treatment that they bring in. And it's just a laparoscopic GYN something kind of case. And they're randomized either to a surgeon who's very nice and very communicative, or a surgeon who is very rude to everyone in the room, but nothing sort of overboard, just sort of like, oh, the insufflator's not working. Why can't I get good equipment in this place? The patient's fighting me. What's wrong with you? Just give more relax with that kind of stuff. No swearing, no throwing of things, just sort of run-of-the-mill incivility. And what we found was on all the domains that we measured, the group that was exposed to simulated incivility. And again, remember, they know this is a simulated environment. They know that this isn't a real situation. But on every domain that we measured, whether those are medical and technical domains, whether those are communication and behavioral domains, their performance was significantly lower than the group that had a surgeon that was communicative. We didn't do the qualitative part of this, but on the videos, you could see like a lot more communication happening with a surgeon that they sort of felt comfortable with. And in each case, when our blinded raters rated them at the end, the incivility exposed residents were rated as just lower overall, just on a global performance rating of sort of, would you let this person take care of a family member? We really pushed these people to the end. They missed simple things. You know, you have a hypotensive patient. You'd think that you want to turn the anesthesia down or maybe start a second IV. They would miss simple stuff like that. They would also miss very, very complicated stuff like communicating with the surgeon to say, hey, maybe you need some help. Can you look around and see if you hit something? The whole thing sort of fell apart, this sort of rattled cage phenomenon of performance. And we've done some follow-up studies. We're doing some ongoing ones now on different aspects of this issue. And I will tell you that it sort of it runs the gamut on the kinds of performance decrements you get. It impairs problem solving, decision making, everything that you could think of preoperatively, intraoperatively. And we're really just starting to crack the hood on this, I think.
Yeah, very interesting. You know, what's fascinating is that it makes sense that if the surgeon is being, you know, kind of aggressive and not particularly nice, you may not be comfortable, or I would totally imagine the residents in the simulation would not maybe ask the surgeon things or communicate as well with the surgeon. But the fact that they, things that had nothing to do with the surgeon, right? So like addressing hypotension, the fact that they had decrements in that is really fascinating. And I think must have to do with the fact that when you're feeling that just discomfort and that incivility, you maybe you're sitting there ruminating about it, thinking like, you know, did what happened here? Did I do something wrong? Or you're just feeling a little shut down or stressed and you don't focus on the things you would normally focus on. Does that kind of ring true?
Yeah. I mean, that's really where I think this becomes interesting is as you said, we expected actually communication and teamwork to go down. That was expected. What we didn't really expect or didn't know what to expect was this other sort of nitty gritty medical decision making stuff. And I always tell people the most likely reason from a cognitive psychology, you know, a performance sort of psychology standpoint is this workload. You know, if you're driving your car into the shopping center and it's snowing and the wind is blowing and it's really hard to see, and your baby's in the back seat and they're crying and you've got the radio on, most people, when they're doing that and they're looking for a parking spot, the first thing they will do is turn the radio down. And they've actually studied this. It's fascinating stuff. But why do they do that? Because we know instinctively that when our workload is too high, our performance will suffer on whatever task we're doing. So you turn the radio down so that you can drive the car into a spot. It's kind of the same thing in this case. You can't really turn this radio down. You can't turn this incivil surgeon down. They're just making everything worse. And then your workload goes through the roof above a threshold, which is sort of imaginary and unmeasurable, but above a threshold at which you can perform really, really well. And you start to just sort of degrade your performance in other domains that aren't just communication. And this is not really a surprise, I think, when you look at sort of what we are evolved to do. And I, you know, I spend a lot of time in the book talking about the evolution of humanity just in general. And it's a big part of what we do is communicate well, collaborate well, and we're very pro-social primates, right? And so we're not really wired for antisocial behavior. When we encounter something that is antisocial, it really rattles us and throws us off. And it's exactly what happens in an acute crisis like this, when you've got, you know, a bit of a jerk on the other side of the drape.
Yeah. Yeah. That is, I think, exactly right. And it makes total sense that, you know, I think you talk about in the book how human beings from very early on were dependent on civility. I mean, that's how we survived, by having a tight-knit group, a tribe, that people supported each other, and that if you were not receiving that support from the group, it was incredibly dangerous. You would potentially be outcast and would die. And so, you know, building that civil interaction is built into us, as you say. But let's talk about how we address this problem. So you go over a lot of really interesting frameworks in the book. Talk about kind of the micro interventions that every individual can use to try to foster a more civil environment.
Sure. I think I'll start with the less cynical approach first, and then we can give a little bit of cynicism to this, because I'm a New York guy. You have to have a little cynicism. First, I think it does start with the individual. It starts with us. You can really only control what you can control. The world's always going to put things in your way. You're always going to have adversity. And certainly I'm not an advocate for if someone speaks to you in a way that you don't like in the middle of a crisis because they were nervous and you were nervous, that that means you should, you know, get their head on a pike because they offended you. We're not talking about simple offense. I think none of us should be arrogant enough in our own ego that we don't think we're going to live a life where people don't offend us. But we've never had a time in the arc of our history where we've been less good at social interactions. The phones in our pockets, the computers that we're on all day, we've ducked out of so many social situations that we just don't get the reps like we used to. So certainly it starts with us trying to communicate better. And on the anesthesia side of things, that means we shouldn't be this passive aggressive specialty. We shouldn't put the drape up as high as we can. We should talk to the people in the operating room and set the tone for the kind of culture that we want in the OR. It's very convenient to say the surgeons bring the cases and we're just sort of in a consultant role. Because that allows you to just kind of duck out of it and be a part of building the culture. But I certainly see the surgical residents, as my residents as well. And they learn in my operating room sort of how we deal with each other. And that's not sort of a draconian thing. That's just, we're friendly. We get to know each other. And I'm not an extroverted kind of person. I'm not interested in grabbing a cocktail with most of my surgical colleagues after work. I just want to make sure we're on the same team, that we're collaborating really well, and that they can tell me their concerns and I can tell them my concerns. So we have to really work very hard as a specialty. Individually, that's how we started, by showing up in the operating room in a way where we are sort of the leaders of the kind of culture that we want. Now, there are environments that are not going to be amenable to our charms, for lack of a better term. So the cynical part of this is I'm a very big fan of it's an old book, but it's a good book, and I always recommend it to people, called Never Split the Difference, by Voss. He's an FBI hostage negotiator. And it's a great book for whether you're going to buy a new car or a house. And it's also a great book for the operating room. And there are lots of really cool psychological tricks and tactics in there, sort of under the bucket of what he would call tactical empathy, for how to deal with people who might not be the easiest to deal with. Things like mirroring the kind of words that they say, or giving them psychological outs. Like, you know, if a surgeon says to me, you know, let's say a patient comes in, they have 7 stents all in their LAD, they should absolutely be on their aspirin. And for whatever reason, the wires got crossed and they're off their aspirin, something I think we deal with quite a bit in anesthesia practice. And it's an elective case and they could very easily be postponed and come back when it's safe to do so. And the surgeon, you know, is sort of pushing back. You know, he's got tactics in there that you say, I'm sure, I know you're not trying to suggest anything XYZ. So I know you're not trying to say anything unsafe. I totally get where you're coming from. But my concern is that we're going to do this elective case on someone who really shouldn't have it done today. This is against every guideline we have. It's potentially malpractice in the making. And I think that we should really cancel this case. And so a lot of it is just these very, very interesting ways to, I don't want to say play on people's psychology, but certainly Ben Franklin knew that if you ask people to do favors for you, they're more not likely to do them for you, and they're more likely to do them for you in the future because it sets them up in their own mind as I'm the kind of person who does favors for you. And the cognitive dissonance of not doing a favor for you prevents them from doing it in the future. So this is just tactical empathy. And the cynic in me says you should learn a few of these because you're going to encounter people in your work environment who aren't necessarily interested in playing on the same team, and you should know how to handle them at the micro level.
Yeah. And there's a great interview, by the way, of that author Voss about this same topic by Barry Weiss on the podcast, Honestly. So folks can check that out too.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey folks, you know what can make a real difference in your quality of life at work? Comfortable scrubs. And not just any scrubs, but Fig scrubs. They're made for awesome humans and I think can truly make a difference for healthcare workers. These are scrubs that have our needs in mind. They're durable, antimicrobial, and super comfortable, which matters when you're 10 hours into your shift. I love my Figs, and let me tell you, my wife, a pediatrician, loves hers too. She wears them to work every day, as do many of the doctors and nurses I work with. It doesn't matter if you're a dentist, a nurse practitioner, an anesthesiologist like me, or even a medical student starting out. Investing in a couple of pairs of Figs is totally worth it. With the holidays right around the corner, it's a perfect time to treat yourself to some fresh looks for the new year, which is great because Figs just dropped a ton of new limited edition colors and styles for the season. If you want to check them out, Figs is offering 15% off your first purchase at wearfigs.com with the code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com with the code FIGSRX. Check them out today and make your life at work a little better in the new year. Hey there, ACRACKers. Fall is my favorite season, and it always feels like a reset between back to school, busier routines, and shorter days. Finding time to cook can be tough. That's why I love Factor. Their chef-prepped, dietitian-approved meals make it easy to stay on track and enjoy something comforting and delicious, no matter how hectic the season gets. My kids think Factor tastes like restaurant food, and it really does. Even my two younger daughters, who are very picky eaters, are loving every meal we get from Factor. Some favorites are the chicken burrito bowl and premium proteins like salmon and shrimp that come at no extra cost. And with 65 different meal options, you've got savory global flavors like the new Asian-inspired meals influenced by China, Thailand, and more. It's not surprising that 97% of customers say Factor helped them live a healthier life. And the amazing thing is that it's not just healthy, but super fast and so delicious. I wouldn't have believed it until I tried it, and now I can't get enough. Get Factor if you want all the flavor and none of the fuss. Get started at factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF and use code ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off your first box plus free breakfast for a year. That's code ACRAC50OFF at factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off plus free breakfast for an entire year. Hey folks, the mornings are getting colder, holidays are coming up. That's when you need a one-stop shop for stuff that looks sharp, feels good, and that is just as tempting to keep for yourself as it is to gift. That's why I go with Quince. Quince has great options like Mongolian cashmere sweaters, and at Quince you can pick one up for $50 when you'd normally drop $200 or more on the same thing. Plus wool coats that actually hold up to daily wear and still look good. They do it by partnering directly with trusted factories that maintain high standards for craftsmanship and ethical practices, cutting out the middlemen and markups. That means premium quality at half the cost of other high-end brands. The zip-up fleece I just got is perfect for these chillier days. It looks good, keeps me warm, and was totally reasonably priced. Even my wife thinks it looks good on me, and that is saying a lot. And Quince has more than just clothing. Have you picked up anything for home, bath, kitchen, or travel to share or keep this holiday? If not, check out the amazing deals from Quince. Get your wardrobe sorted and your gift list handled with Quince. Don't wait. Go to quince.com/ACRAC for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/ACRAC. Free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/ACRAC. Hey, ACRACKers. We are thrilled to have as a returning sponsor the one and only TrueLearn Smart Banks. I've used TrueLearn for my residents for years, and it is hands down the best smart bank out there. The questions are excellent, and the answers have clear explanations that break down why each choice is correct or incorrect. I love that it's customizable, so you can target weak areas or take a longer or shorter practice exam anytime. Their metrics are great, and their mobile app lets you study on the go. We use their ITE, basic, and advanced smart banks for our residents, each with 1,000-plus questions, realistic visuals and graphs, and even a calculator that mimics what you have on the exam. Our residents love it and get great results. TrueLearn even has a CME Smart Bank where you can get AMA, PRA, Category 1 credits after you finish training, and an adult cardiac anesthesiology Smart Bank as well. And now they have a fabulous flashcard product, which you can check out, and I highly recommend it. Go to TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAC to get $25 off residency exams, USMLE, and Comlex Smart Bank subscriptions of 90 days or longer, and up to 20% off other healthcare exam subscriptions. We rely on TrueLearn for our test prep, and I recommend you do the same. TrueLearn.com and use code ACCRAC.
All right, and we're back. So, what if you're a resident? You know, you're a resident, maybe you're a first-year resident, and you're in the OR with a very senior surgeon who is being incivil. How do you address that? Is it the same? I mean, you recommend using kind of the same technique and language, which I think is a lot harder if you're a junior person. I mean, I think it's hard for anybody, even an attending anesthesiologist, but I think it's even harder for a junior resident. Or are there other ways, or do they not? Do they need to just call their attending and say, you know, I'm feeling like the surgeon is being, you know, incivil?
Yeah, certainly there. It's interesting. There's even been a study on putting residents through a conflict resolution course and then exposing them to incivility again in a simulated environment, and showing that they actually improve their ability to communicate with someone who's being a little inappropriate. I think it's a couple of things for the residents. Yes, there's this understood hierarchy which might make them feel powerless, but certainly that's not the case. So you really do have to convince yourself that the behavior that you're seeing around you, if it's incivil, is going to reach the patient. It's bad for the patient. So sometimes it's a deep breath. Maybe it's a little bit of a pep talk to yourself that you're going to have to stand up and you're going to have to say something professionally, of course. And I do recommend, actually, and I often tell our residents that I do think that they should think about the dynamics of the operating room as much of a subject to be studied and read about and learned as they would the volume of distribution of remifentanil, right? So I think, yes, the Voss book is a great place to start for sure. I think any bit of YouTube TED talk from Christine Parath is important, because I think she's really masterfully identified and summated how incivility really hurts our work performance. And I think they really do have to bring their attendings in. And I'm a big fan of having a good conversation with your surgical colleagues when you can. And never to weaponize reporting, because I hate that. I hate when you see that somebody fills out one of those event things for nothing at all. But when things get to a point where you really do feel that this is inappropriate, I know as physicians, for some reason, we always feel like if we use these systems, we're somehow, you know, we're tattletales or we're whatever. But I think we do have to use those systems that are in place for event reporting. When we think things have crossed over the line. So try everything you can in your power, obviously. Bring in your supervisor, your attending, your chair, whoever you have to bring in. But don't be afraid to use the systems that are available to you. I mean, certainly at Sinai, we have this, they call it a cup of coffee. It sort of stands for something where if someone has a professionalism complaint about, you know, against them, they actually sit down with a colleague who's in their specialty, I guess potentially over a cup of coffee. I've never had one, thankfully, so I don't know. But and they kind of just talk it through, as opposed to just sending you right to anger management or something that way. And I think the program is fairly successful. So it's one of those rare instances, I think, where some of this red tape kind of reporting system stuff does help people get the sense of like, hey, your behaviors really aren't where they need to be, and this is a warning, and you're sort of on the radar. And for some people, it does help.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really important. And to see these kind of things not different than someone who, you know, made a physical, you know, kind of in transgression, right? So if somebody, you know, threw something at somebody, then you would, I think most people would say, yeah, we need to write that up as an event. But, you know, the incivility part is just verbal. I think people are less likely to, but it's just as important. So let's do maybe a couple of sort of semi role plays. I mean, let's say that I'm a resident, I'm in the OR, and I'm with a attending surgeon who is just, you know, saying things like, he's kind of saying, oh, you know, the patient is clearly awake. They're moving. You know, what's the matter with you? You know, I thought we agreed zero twitches. Are you even paying attention back there? You know, they're not swearing, they're not throwing, they're not yelling, they're just making these kind of disparaging comments. Let's say that you're my attending, you're not in the room with me, but let's say you were like on my shoulder as a little, you know, a little angel, and you're whispering in my ear. What would you tell me to say in that moment, if anything?
Yeah, I think it starts really with diffusing some of the situation. A big part of it is, again, remember this person probably at this point, what's driving their complaints toward, let's assume, by the way, zero twitches. You just gave 100 of Rocuronium 3 minutes ago, right? What's driving them right now is essentially fear and stress, right? There's something going wrong. They're having trouble getting exposure or whatever it is. We've all sort of seen this, right? And I'm not going to suggest that I've ever given the slug of saline that we used to get taught to give when they complain about paralysis that's already on board. But I do think it starts by standing up and saying, what's going on? Patients moving all over the place. That's something that maybe there is something you don't know. And that's another thing is maybe be open. Remember, you know, surgeons are stressed out because they're stapled to the floor in a way that we aren't, right? We get to move our bodies a little bit. We can grab things and do stuff. They just got their one position and they're focused in their one area. And that can be really, really stressful just physically for them. And so it starts by actually maybe hearing out that the diaphragm is moving all over the place. Maybe it is time to redose your relaxant. Maybe your IV's out and it's not getting there. Okay. So I think first be open-minded. The days of just being like, shut up, surgeon, I think are gone. And for good reason. And so be open-minded. Maybe there's something you don't know here, but assuming that this isn't that, I would say I just redosed the relaxant. It doesn't work right away. I just want you to know that. Why don't we just wait a couple minutes? And then you want me to ask you again? And then that feels like they got something, because a lot of this is that they need to feel that there's a transaction was made. They're not yelling at you because they want you to ignore them. And they're certainly not yelling at you for a response back that's equally aggressive, but they'll take it, right? Because at least it's a response. They're kind of saying something because they want a response and they want to know that you're engaged in the same way that they are and you're trying to help them, let's say. So I think create sort of boundaries that say, I just gave some, it doesn't work right away. How about I check back in 2 minutes when it will really take effect is a lot better than saying, well, I've got zero twitches, so I don't know how to help you. Because what it does is it makes a time-bound response. It could be completely artificial. You could probably not have to redose the Rocuronium. You could probably just in that time, check that your electrodes are on the right place and you really do have zero twitches. But it does give them something. There is a transaction. You check back in, which shows that you care. And sometimes that's all that it takes is just to say, how's it now? Is it better now? And I have found in my many years of this that 9 times out of 10, they're like, oh, it's so much better now. What did you do? And you're like, oh, I did exactly what you asked for, doctor. Even if you did absolutely nothing. Now, again, it's cynical. It is tactical empathy, but you have to know that you're not necessarily dealing with the same person that you met preoperatively. They might be really stressed out right now. And so they're sort of not necessarily thinking about the best social interaction that they could have. And so you've got to just sort of like play into that as opposed to just putting up a wall and fighting them immediately.
Yeah, great. I love that. And I do think that that engagement, that willingness to not rise to the bait, not get really mad, just say, look, this isn't personal, right? This is, they're stressed, clearly. They're stressed about something. Maybe they've got some bleeding. Maybe they aren't getting where they need to get. And this is how they're manifesting that stress. It doesn't mean it's good, but it also doesn't mean that we, you know, that it's going to help if we kind of rise to that bait. And so understanding that and then trying to have some sort of give and take. I'm happy to let me check again. I just gave some rock or let me check in with you in 2 minutes when I know this has taken effect. Just giving them something. And it even, you said before, giving them an out. I think in a way that's an out, right? Is that I think sometimes surgeons will say something like that and they realize that it maybe wasn't very nice. But they, you know, what are they going to do? Be like, sorry, let me take back what I just said. But if you say, if you give them that out, like, well, you know, I just gave some, let me just check Twitches again and I'll check back in with you in 2 minutes. It gives them a way to be like, great, and to not further pursue that. And I think as a resident, if that doesn't work and they start getting more angry and aggressive, that's where I think you do need to let your attending know and call for some help.
Absolutely. And certainly, you know, for many years, I worked with a wonderful surgeon who has since passed away. And he was an old school guy and did all, you know, sinus surgery, and deliberate hypotension was very important for hemostasis. And it was amazing that when I would leave the room, immediately he would say that the bleeding is uncontrollable. What are you doing? And I would always tell the resident at the start of the day, give him a couple of plans of attack and say, okay, I'm going up on X, Y, and Z. Even if the blood pressure is 40 over 20, tell him that you're starting, you know, labetalol at, you know, 10 milligrams per second or something like that. Even if that's not what you're doing, but just give him sort of like a stepwise progression. Say, okay, let me try this. Let me try that. And then if that doesn't work, just call me into the room and I'll pop back in. And I'll tell him that we're putting the tourniquet around the neck. That's what I always used to say to him. And then he would say, amazing, you fixed it already. And I would be there for like 20 seconds. And some of it was just comfort level with that maybe junior resident, or maybe the reaction he got didn't seem mature enough or something like that. And so it was all a big psychological undertaking. And look, I do think that you could walk away with a lot of this thinking, oh, it's so resentful of the fact that I even have to play this game, but all of your interactions with human beings are negotiations. Whether those are your children who don't want to go to sleep yet and they want to stay up and watch a movie, or like I said, you're buying a car. It's all a negotiation, and that's okay. You don't have to seek an apology. You don't have to hope for a better situation. It's just that you do have to know how to play the game, and you can play it in a way where you make things better for the care that everyone is providing. And ultimately, look, at least if you have to play a game, at least you know it's benefiting your patient. And I would much rather do that than to get into big arguments with people and big spats, or God forbid, do anything stupid in the operating room, than to just do a good job for the person that I'm tasked with caring for.
Absolutely. Let's talk about the one I brought up before. What if your resident is doing their pre-op discussion and they are literally mid-sentence and the attending surgeon walks into the pre-op bay and just starts talking to the patient? It just completely interrupts as if your resident's not even there. And again, you're not actually there, but you're in there on their shoulder. What would you tell them to say in that moment or to do?
Yeah, I mean, that's a difficult one, and certainly happens, and I've seen it happen. I've had it happen to me as an attending working alone with a surgeon that I never met. I'll never forget that. My instincts in that situation were probably wrong, because I definitely didn't like it and reacted. As I say, I preach this stuff, but I'm as fallible as anyone else. The best you can do in a situation like that is to reestablish civility in a way that, again, gives them an out, but sends a message very clearly that this isn't the game we're going to play. And so what I've done, again, since I've been much more academically immersed in this topic, is you actually say, oh, hello. Afterwards, like, you know, you don't do it in front of the patient, obviously. And you say, I realized in the middle of my talk with, you know, the patient that you and I must not have ever met, which is why you grabbed the chart from me, thinking maybe I was a student or something like that. But I'm Sam. I'm the anesthesiologist in the room. Nice to meet you. I'm sure that the order of things is you're usually this way, where we introduce ourselves and then we see the patients. But I hope the rest of the day, that's the way we're going to sort of do things. And, you know, I did actually do that to a urologist who I had never met before. And she had kind of come in and interrupted me in the middle of a pre-op history while, you know, my patient was setting up the room. And then I took her aside and I said, you know, normally the sequence of events is you and I say hello to one another. We get to know each other. And I say, hi, I'm Sam. And you say, hi, I'm so-and-so. Now, this person happened to be like an assistant professor of urology. Like, she was like very green. And I said, so I decided to do a little pull of rank. I said, normally I would say, like, I'm Sam. I'm one of the anesthesia vice chairs. Great to meet you. But I realized that's not how this went down today. So this is me starting over with you so that we – the rest of the day goes really, really smoothly. And I think she kind of understood that this was a tacit, like, hey, don't do that again. Don't pull that kind of stuff. It did not improve her behavior, I will say. But for the rest of the day, we kind of knew what we were dealing with. You know, again, we got through it as best as we really could. And again, sadly enough, I do think this is what it's like to work in many operating rooms. It's better than it probably was 30, 40 years ago. It's not going to be perfect. But we just do our best as long as we're armed with the kind of things that we need to make the situation a little bit nicer for the person that we're caring for.
Yeah, I think this is a super hard one. And obviously, you got the added, you've got the incivility, and then you've got the patient sitting right there, right? So that makes it really, really hard. I like your approach to kind of how to deal with it afterwards. I think what you just described obviously works for you because you're with a junior surgeon when you're a more senior anesthesiologist. I think that what I have suggested is to my residents is if this happens to them, is in the moment, I think you could, and I'm interested to hear what you think about this, but I think that in the moment, in front of the patient, you definitely don't want to, you know, start a brawl, but I think you could say something like, oh my goodness, it looks like your surgeon, like the surgeon starts talking, and you could then say, like, essentially interrupt back, but not to say, excuse me. You could interrupt to just say to the patient, oh my goodness, it looks like your surgeon is here. You know what? Let's just really quick finish up our last few things, and then I'm going to let you and him have, you know, have all the time you need. And I think that is, I think that that is probably acceptable to anyone. It doesn't look bad to the patient. It doesn't look like there's a conflict. And I think with most surgeons, I mean, I want to believe this, and I hope it's true, that most of the time what has happened here is not that they walked in and said, oh, look, there's the anesthesia resident. I don't care what they're doing. I'm going to just interrupt them. I think, and I'm not trying to justify this, but I think what probably happens is they literally aren't seeing you. Like, they walk in, and they've got a million things going on in their head, and they walk in, and they're just like, all right, I got it. Hey, to the patient. And they're not even paying attention to what's happening. They may think you're the loved one, the partner, right? And I get it. I get that doesn't really make sense because you're sitting there holding the chart. But, you know, again, they're not sitting there evaluating this over a period of time. They're just walking in, and they probably are registering. There's somebody sitting over there, somebody standing over there. Maybe that's the patient's, you know, significant other. And so they just start talking. And I think for most of them, if you give them a little gentle reminder, like what I just laid out, they're going to be like, oh my goodness, yeah, please finish, right? And the few exceptions who might be like, sorry, like you're going to have to finish after I'm done, then I think that's, if I were the resident at that point, I would then say to my attending, hey, this just happened, and then I said this, and they were very rude about it, and let the attending handle that.
Yeah, I think that's totally reasonable. I mean, the beauty about all of this stuff is that there's a lot of gray area there. And certainly you have to imagine the surgeon has a relationship with the patient that you don't have. They've seen them for, you know, days, weeks, months leading up to the surgery. They see each other. And most times, you know, patients will sort of train their eyes towards the surgeon. What's the surgeon going to do at that point? Not say hello, even though you're in the middle of your history. And so you do have to give them yourself, right? You do have to give them an out there as well. You would probably do the same thing. Very different than stealing the chart from them or just like shutting them down. But I think many times the surgeon kind of comes in while you're midstream and now they're chatting too. The good surgeons, the ones that, you know, sort of we're blessed to work with regularly, just go, I'm going to come back after, you know, he's done chatting with you or something like that. But even if they don't, it's again, it's not the end of the world. You have to always check, as I say, your own arrogance to being offended. And certainly give people a pass. You know, the thing I always try to especially when I speak with mixed audiences, is I always try to emphasize to the anesthesia part of that crowd is that, you know, we don't do ourselves a lot of favors because we often look like we don't care. We're back there with our feet up. And so many times it's, you know, again, not justifying, but many times they don't really think much of the people in our specialty. So you have to sort of shoulder all that individually many times, because maybe the last 20 anesthesia providers this person encountered, like, they didn't care, and he could say whatever he wants, or she could say whatever they wanted in front of the patient and just push you out of the way. So just deal with everybody individually. Most people, especially if after an interaction like that, you go up to them and just say, oh, hey, I realized that when you came in, we hadn't really met yet. I'm Sam. Nice to meet you. We're working together today. Most people are more than happy to have that conversation because they didn't even think that it was offensive to do what they did. And for sure, it's not the end of the world if they did something like that. But you don't want them to sort of make a pattern of dismissing you in general. So if it feels like that's what was going on, then you probably have to just handle it a little bit differently.
Yeah.
Than just kind of giving them a pass.
Great. So let's talk about the future. We've talked a lot about kind of like the individual, how do you handle these individually? And even what does, you know, how might you have like a coffee talk with maybe a brilliant jerk who is causing problems, but how for the long term, what does an institution do to become a truly civil institution? How do we get to a truly civil healthcare culture? What do we need to do?
It's a big, lofty goal, I would say. We're probably at a time in our arc of societal history, even, where civility is at an all-time low, right? We're sort of more polarized than we've ever been. We're more convinced our opinions are the right opinions than we've ever been, which I think actually travels in parallel too with the fact that we're seeing more workplace civility. And again, healthcare is probably one of the worst, but this is true in almost every other kind of work. So how do we fix this? I don't think you can do it without leadership at the hospital level believing that this is the right way to conduct ourselves. I think we have to actually go back to really, really old principles where we felt like our white coats meant something, where we felt like our oaths really meant something, and where we truly believe that you know, it's not just the patients aren't an ATM machine that come to the hospital. They are actually a human being with families and lives and work to get back to. And so because of that, we have to put on this very, very real act for them, that everybody that's there together is there for them, that everybody that they're encountering today is on the same team, and that we're all trying to get them over the finish line today in the safest way possible. I'd say that's very, very lofty and very, very 30,000 foot. And you've got to hope that your hospital administrators all believe in this and that they don't just say, this person brings in 50 cabbages a month and that's all that matters. They can say what they want. Now, I think the way that we affect that change from the inside out as a specialty is we have a better sense of decorum. We really start to believe that what we do is important, that we're not a service line. Certainly in my department, you know, our hospital president was our former chair. So for us, we feel very, very empowered to be anesthesiologists, even if it's not always easy in every cluster. And the way that you get that across is you don't just cooperate with your surgical colleagues, you collaborate with them. It's much harder to abuse people that are part of your tribe. You know, we talked about the tribe very briefly earlier. We are very tribal as animals go. There's a lot of us versus them that we do whenever we can do it. Well, what if the us was just everybody who works in the operating room, as opposed to anesthesia versus surgery, anesthesia versus nursing, nurses versus surgeons? And collaboration is the only way you do that. You've probably heard, you know, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. So I always give the same example here, but I think it's important. I've worked pretty consistently at Mount Sinai for the past 15 years on like one particular floor with a pretty tight group of surgeons. Probably 80% of my time is spent up there with those folks. And every couple of years, it's a big crisis that we got to improve the on-time starts and we've got to improve the turnover and all this kind of stuff. Now, I don't really care because, you know, if it starts at 8:05 or it starts at 8 o'clock, I'm probably going to be fine. If the turnover is 30 minutes or if it's 38 minutes, I don't really care. But I show up to that meeting and I feign my outrage with them and I say, yeah, we absolutely have to get into the rooms at 8 o'clock. And so they know that I'm united with them against this sort of common enemy of inefficiency. And we see each other as collaborators, and it's really, really hard to abuse collaborators. And that's how you form the tribe with them. You sit with them, join the committees that they're on, and you take up the problems that are their that they see as just their problems, and no one's there to help them. We live a very different life in anesthesia. We show up into the room, we set up our equipment, and we're ready to go. They show up, they don't know what's coming out of the box day to day. And we would be super frustrated if every time we opened up a laryngoscope, the light failed, you know, but that happens to them all the time. So try to make their problems your problems, get on the same team with them, be good stewards of the operating room. And I think we really, at least in the OR, can fix a lot of our cultural issues by just teaming up with our surgical colleagues as much as we can.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that makes such a difference. I actually feel very lucky to work in the ICU as well as the OR, because that is a great example of where the surgeons that I work with in the ICU, we talk all the time. We're discussing patients. What do we want to do day to day over time? And then when we're in the OR together, we know each other. There's mutual respect. And so that makes those interactions a lot better. Now, obviously, not everyone works in the ICU, but I think even little that you've brought up some great ways, you know, whether it's joining committees, whether it's, you know, going to a joint grand rounds and saying hello to some people, you know, there's lots of ways to build those relationships. I also think that even little saying hello in pre-op, I send an email the night before to every surgeon I'm working with the next day. I've done that from the time I finished training. And even that little thing means that we've had a touch point. We've touched base. They've heard from me. They know I've looked in the case, that I care, that I'm asking them some questions, introduce myself. I always copy my resident on it. And I say, this is my resident, Sam, you know, who's working with us tomorrow. So the surgeon has their name and knows them. And I think all that stuff can make a big difference too.
For sure. For sure.
Well, Sam, we've covered a lot of great stuff. Anything that you want to add before we move on?
No, I really appreciate you having me. I'm happy to talk about this topic endlessly almost.
Awesome. Well, I highly recommend people check out your book. It's great. It's easy to read. It really flies by. And you go in really, one thing I love is there's even some bonus chapters in there that go into a lot of detail about some very much on the ground things you can do as an individual, as a team, to start addressing things and making change. And that's really, really high yield. But let's move to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. Do you have something you'd recommend the audience check out for fun?
Sure. I think I'll do one highbrow and one lowbrow recommendation if that's okay.
Absolutely.
The highbrow recommendation is, you know, I'm a big evolutionary biology nerd. It's like sort of my, it was probably my calling that I missed. But I love all the books by Nick Lane, and he recently published a book called Oxygen, and it's just about how oxygen on our planet drove our evolution and how it influences the way that we live and even the way that we die. And then my lowbrow recommendation will be that my son is 13, and he and I recently started watching the worst possible movies that we could pick for one another, so I made him watch the movie Deep Blue Sea, which is like a really great shark movie with Samuel L. Jackson and some other people. And it's really, really just like kind of an awful, awful movie. And then he made me watch a movie he found called Birdemic. And I have to say, it's the single worst movie I've ever seen, but we were laughing the entire time. So I highly, highly recommend that you subject yourself to Birdemic. I think it's on like Prime Video right now or something like that. And it was free, so you don't have to spend any money.
That's pretty funny. Okay, awesome. I'm going to recommend a book I just read that my brother recommended to me called Small Mercies by Dennis Lehane. Really, really great book. It's a historical novel set in South Boston at the time of integration in the 70s. And it's also a kind of a murder mystery. And it's really well done. Very, very interesting history. And then just really kind of gripping murder mystery. So highly recommend it. Small Mercies by Dennis Lehane. All right, Sam, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Jed. I really appreciate it.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrack.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at Acrack Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrack. That's patreon.com/accrack, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/acrack. Or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead. Taylor Duggan, William Mao, and Rachel Furman are our production assistants and social media managers. Thanks so much for all you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC Podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.